Thanks for that wonderful introduction. I'm really at the beginning of a process here. This book has been in print for 48 hours. This is the very first time I've spoken about it in public. And frankly, I couldn't ask for a better launching pad. If you could ask me any place in America I'd like to give my first talk, it would be here. On Friday, I'm speaking at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, which I'm told is near some college or university or something. But for me, this institution has actually meant more than whatever that place is. So it's really wonderful not only to be here, but to be able to start this process right here before you start hearing me on Fresh Air or seeing me on, believe it or not, Fox News. You'll be able to see me here, and it's really a thrill, especially seeing what's happening in Washington these days. It's hard to imagine that there's something positive happening in this city, in this community, but coming in here, you really have some hope. That may be unjustified, but I don't care. It's just wonderful to be here and share our interests and our hopes through our talk about this book. Let me talk a little bit about how I came to write this book, and then I'll make a few observations about the Dulles brothers. I think, as you heard in the introduction, we sometimes ask, they sometimes say the good that men does or doesn't live after them. What about the bad that men do? I feel like, in a way, the bad that the Dulles brothers did not live after them. But I want to bring it back. I want you to know where it started. When I used to write articles in the New York Times, which I did for more than 20 years, I had a pose as a newsman. But actually, now that I left the New York Times, I can admit something I couldn't have said then, which is actually I'm not interested in news. What I'm really interested in is olds. I was never interested in writing about what's happening today. What I was really interested in writing about was two other things. Number one is, what happened yesterday? What produced what just happened today? And the other thing was, tomorrow. So what is what happened today going to mean for the future? This was a little frustrating for some of my editors. I once was told by one of my spies on the foreign desk that he overheard the editors discussing one of my stories, and one said to the other, "Do you think Kinzer will ever write a story about something that happened less than 100 years ago?" That was a little exaggerated. I would start with what happened today, but I did probably more than some other reporters try to stick a few paragraphs in there that tried to place this in some historical context. Now we're looking around the world and seeing some terrible crises, and we've lived through terrible crises. But in many cases, I think we tend to believe these crises simply emerge out of nothing. I remember reading that before Darwin, the idea of evolution, people believed in something called spontaneous generation, that species would just emerge suddenly. And I think we have this theory a little bit about world crises. Nothing causes them. They just suddenly emerge. This is the kind of reporting that I detest. I want to know, why is it happening? We spent a tragic couple of decades fighting in Vietnam at the cost of a million lives, including those of 50,000 Americans. I just came back from Guatemala, where 200,000 civilians were slaughtered by the government in a 35-year civil war. Look at the crisis we are facing in Iran and how much suffering and tyranny the Iranians have had to live under and what that has produced for the rest of the world. Think of the literally millions who have died in conflicts in the Congo over the last 15 years. Why is this all happening? Every one of those episodes has roots in the era of the Dulles brothers. And without the Dulles brothers, these crises would probably never have emerged, certainly not at the level that they've emerged now. As you heard years ago, more years ago than I like to remember, I wrote a book about how the United States overthrew the elected government of Guatemala in 1954. Years later, when I was posted in Turkey and I started visiting Iran, I got interested in the question of why Iran is like this. Why is a country with this history and this culture so poor and isolated and unhappy? Well,
people there told me that we had a democracy once, but the Americans came over and overthrew it. So I decided I needed to read a book about what happened. And there was no book on that subject. So I realized if I wanted to read that book, I'd have to write it. And I did. That was another book, All the Shah's Men. Across the pages of those two books are many footprints of John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles. More recently, I wrote a book called Overthrow, about the 14 times the United States has overthrown foreign governments. There you see the Dulles brothers coming up again. I became more and more interested in them, and I was dissatisfied with having written books in which they were supporting characters or minor characters. I began to realize that this wasn't telling the story correctly. So what I've done in this book is try to rescue the Dulles brothers from the obscurity into which they have fallen. And then through the framework of biography, try to ask the larger question of why the United States acts the way it does in the world. Why are we like this? Because the Dulles brothers actually did not hijack American foreign policy. They didn't go off on a secret direction of their own. They did what we wanted. They're us, and we're them. So telling their story is really telling the story of America. Through them, I think we come to understand a great deal, not only about why the world is the way we are, but about ourselves as a nation. The fact that they tell us so much about ourselves, I think, is a large part of the reason why they've been forgotten. What they tell us about ourselves is really not what we want to hear. While I was writing this book, I was reminded over and over of the obscurity into which the Dulles brothers have fallen. Remember that these people had earth-shattering power. They made and broke nations, and they set some countries on paths to tragedy that are still having terrible effects. There was probably no literate human being in the entire world that did not know the name Dulles. But now, when I told people I'm writing a book about Dulles, often they would look at me and say, "The airport?" That's the level to which they have fallen. So I decided I wanted to make them the central characters of a book. And really, there has not been a book about the Dulles brothers in this century. So since we have learned all we now know from declassified documents and we're able to put much more together now than we could then, nobody has focused on them. So let me tell you a little bit about their background and then a little bit about what they did as they emerged from that background. These were two of the most extraordinary siblings in American history. They grew up in Watertown, New York, on the shores of Lake Ontario, which was kind of a playground for the New York rich. Their two greatest mentors as children were their uncle and their grandfather. They grew up in a parsonage. The father was a clergyman. The grandfather had been a clergyman and a missionary. The great-grandfather had been a clergyman and a missionary. So the atmosphere of missionary Calvinism permeated them. They started every day with prayers. They had to listen to three services every day of their father's, every Sunday. Then they had to take notes so they could discuss the sermons later. They sang hymns at night. So they were immersed in that missionary Christianity. And then after they'd get up every morning in the summertime, take their cold shower, only kind their father would allow, and then rush down to the shore of Lake Ontario where their grandfather and their uncle would be waiting to take them out in boats to stock the wily smallmouth bass. Alan Dulles actually wrote later on that the experience of trapping the fish and playing the fish and getting the fish to the point where he was almost happy to be caught and reeled in, is actually the experience that set him off in the direction of espionage. Now, the grandfather had already been Secretary of State. He was John Watson Foster, who was Secretary of State in the 1890s. He was the first Secretary of State to preside over the an American operation to overthrow a foreign government. He was the Secretary of State when the United States overthrew the government of Hawaii and seized it for ourselves. So he's the one who actually put the United States into the regime change business. Quite remarkable when you think that the family business was then carried on in the 50s by his two grandchildren. And their uncle, Robert Lansing, also became Secretary of State during World War I. So these were the two principal influences on them. John Watson Foster was a classic American figure from the age of Manifest Destiny. He had gone out into the frontier and faced the wild savages and built himself a business and made himself friendly with people of influence, became one himself, worked in presidential campaigns, helped manipulate at least a couple of election returns, and was given a series of diplomatic posts that ultimately led him to the pinnacle of being Secretary of State. He transmitted the ethos of Manifest Destiny and American exceptionalism, which he had lived as a pioneer, to his grandchildren. So here you have a whole continuum. The grandfather had actually campaigned for Abraham Lincoln, and the grandsons projected American power all around the world in the nuclear age. This is the real span of American history in one family. The Dulles brothers grew up in an atmosphere of privilege. Their grandfather, John Watson Foster, doted on them. And it wasn't enough for him to spend summers with them in Watertown. He wanted to bring them to Washington to live with him during the winter. And they came for many months and lived actually right here near DuPont Circle in John Watson Foster's house. At dinner, the other guests were Bernard Baruch, Grover Cleveland, Woodrow Wilson, William Howard Taft, Andrew Carnegie. These were the people they were having dinner with when they were 10 years old. Of course, they didn't participate in the discussions, but they were able to assimilate not just the ideas that shaped the ruling elite in America, but their style and their perceptions and the way they acted and behaved and understood the world. So from a very young age, they were shaped as vessels of American history. Later on in life, both of the brothers became corporate lawyers, and they worked for the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell in New York. Sullivan and Cromwell was a unique institution. It's called a law firm, but it's really not like any other law firm in America. If you really needed a contract drawn up or you needed to be represented in a court case, they would have somebody that could do that. But that's not what they focused on. They had a real specialty. Their specialty was pressuring small countries to do what American companies wanted them to do. The very first assignment that John Foster Dulles had at Sullivan and Cromwell, when he was actually, they called it a clerk. He was already a lawyer, but he was the very lowest rank. He was making $50 a month, which, of course, Grandfather Foster generously subsidized extra. His first assignment was this. An American agricultural company that produced flour wanted to export flour to Guyana. But Guyana had erected a tariff wall to protect the domestic producers, so the flour company was not able to compete and put the Guyanese flour producers out of business. So the flour company, what do you do in a situation like this? You go hire Sullivan and Cromwell. And you tell Sullivan and Cromwell, our problem is the government of Guyana is placing a higher tariff on imported flour than we want. We want to get rid of that tariff. The only place you could go in America to get that done was Sullivan and Cromwell. And that was the very first assignment that John Foster Dulles was given as a young, what we call now an associate at Sullivan and Cromwell. He made his way to Guyana. He had his negotiations. When he came back, there were no more tariffs on imported flour for Guyana. The slogan of Sullivan and Cromwell was not, we make offers they can't refuse, but it could have been. A few years later, Foster Dulles was sent off on another assignment, very typical for Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell represented most of the American businesses that were active in Cuba. Their clients controlled most of the sugar plantations in Cuba, nearly all of the rail lines, the cement company, and most of the economic investment in Cuba. An election was held, and the Conservative Party, which had always bowed down in front of American power, was defeated, not surprisingly. The Liberal Party won on a platform we are going to restrict through taxes and tariffs the ability of American companies to function freely in Cuba so we can build up a domestic industry and domestic agriculture. Well, this was horrifying to these companies. And they were, as I said, already represented by Sullivan and Cromwell. Sullivan and Cromwell existed to prevent damage to giant American corporations. So John Foster Dulles was given this job. It could have been given to other lawyers, but he was chosen because he had already shown in a number of other assignments his skill at this kind of manipulation. The very next day, John Foster Dulles got on the train in Penn Station. He came to Washington, D.C. He went to see Uncle Bert, otherwise known as Secretary of State Lansing. He told Uncle Bert, we need to send two warships to Cuba, one for the northern part of the island where the rebels are active, and one on the southern part, and we got to land Marines there, and we got to put down the liberals who have won the election and make sure the conservatives who have lost the election can stay in power. The next day, those warships were sent. 6,000 Marines landed in Cuba. They crushed the liberal protests and remained occupying Cuba for the next 6 years. That was the kind of work that John Foster Dulles did as a private lawyer. So he naturally came to associate the interests of large American corporations with the interests of the United States. Those were our interests. He never really saw any difference between those. Meanwhile, Allen Dulles followed a somewhat different course. He worked as a spy master in Switzerland during both World Wars. In between, going back to Sullivan and Cromwell, after the Second World War, he went back to Sullivan and Cromwell. In Sullivan and Cromwell's official prospectus, it says something like, we have unusual and confidential ways of obtaining information. That was Allen Dulles' job. It was like a super spy, but instead of working for the American intelligence agency, since there was none at that time, he did his work for Sullivan and Cromwell. So, this provides the second big strain in their mentality. The first was missionary Calvinism. This was very important, I think, for one key reason. The Dulles brothers were brought up in a religious environment that preached the idea that the world is divided between good forces and evil forces. There's the forces of God, and there's the satanic forces. And Christians do not have the option of sitting at home and hoping that good triumphs over evil. They must go out in the world, like the Dulles brothers' own father and grandfather and great-grandfather, and bring the heathens to see the light. It is a very short step from believing that to believing that there's good and evil politics in the world. There's regimes that are good, and there's others that are evil. And if you're good, you don't have the right to just say it's too bad there's evil out there. You must go out there and fight that evil. You must bring it down. Now, this Manichaean view of the world, in some ways, is classically American. Many other cultures have a very different view. And they would say good and evil coexist in every person and in every government, and they come out in different proportions depending on circumstances. This was not the Dulles view. Everything was either good or evil. And since they were drilled in this view from a religious perspective, they also applied it in their view of geopolitics. That was the first force that shaped them. The second force that shaped them was corporate power. They spent their whole adult lives, essentially, working to defend the right of large American corporations to operate freely in other countries. And they developed all kinds of methods to be sure that small countries would not obstruct the ability of their clients to earn great profits. Now, in the early 1950s, Sullivan and Cromwell, and in particular the Dulles brothers, suffered two terrible and most unaccustomed defeats. They were sworn above all to protect and defend the interests of their clients. Once a big multinational corporation has hired the Dulles brothers, those corporations are safe. The Dulles brothers will defend them. That's the reason those companies hired the Dulles brothers, and that worked for decades. In 1951, the Dulles brothers suffered two shocks. First of all, the elected prime minister of Iran, with the approval of the unanimous vote of the parliament of Iran, nationalized the Iranian oil industry. That industry was controlled by a British company, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and that oil company's financial agent, its bank, was something called the Schroeder Bank, which was one of the biggest international banks at that time. The Schroeder Bank was a client of the Dulles brothers. And in fact, Alan Dulles actually sat on the board of directors of the Schroeder Bank. So the Schroeder Bank had hired him to be sure that its interests in Iran were safe. And what happened? Its interests in Iran were attacked and virtually liquidated by Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran. They were not able to protect their client. This had never happened to them before. Soon thereafter, in tiny Guatemala, also with the approval of the elected Congress of Guatemala, the government under President Jacobo Arbenz passed a land reform law. Under this land reform law, if you had a very large amount of land and you weren't using most of it, you had to sell that land to the government. And that unused land would then be cut up into small pieces and distributed out to peasants. The biggest landowner in Guatemala was the United Fruit Company. And the United Fruit Company was a principal client of Sullivan and Cromwell. United Fruit also secured its hold over Guatemala through two other companies. They owned IRCA, the International Railroads of Central America, that controlled the whole rail system of Guatemala. And they also owned the electric company that generated all of Guatemala's electricity. All three of those companies were clients of the Dulles brothers. And their financial agent was, surprise, the Schroeder Bank. So this meant that the Dulles brothers had also failed the United Fruit Company. For decades, they had been able to assure a steady flow of profits for the United Fruit Company and for themselves, since they were both stockholders in the fruit company. Now, something had gone terribly wrong in the world, and there were two bad guys that did it. The Dulles brothers believed something that I think many Americans still believe, and that is, if there's problems in the world, it's got to be because there's just a few bad people. If people are doing something in the world that is undercutting American power, it has to be because there's a small clique of evildoers, if I can use that phrase. It can't be that there are legitimate reasons for this. I think this is also something that we like to believe about ourselves. And I think it's not just us as a nation. We think about ourselves this way as individuals. I do. For example, like, I am a really nice guy. There's no reason that any of you or anybody wouldn't like me. If you don't like me, there can only be two reasons. Number one is you don't know me. You don't realize what a great guy I am. Or number two, you're actually a jerk yourself. So naturally, you wouldn't like a nice guy like me. The idea that you know exactly who I am, you know me well, and you're a good person yourself, but you don't like me, this is not possible because I'm such a good person. I think this is the way Americans often look at the world, that it's not possible that there could be large groups of well-informed, patriotic people in another country who would like to take steps that the Americans don't want them to take. This can't be. It must be that they've been misled by a tiny clique of bad people. And the Dulles brothers identified exactly who those two people were. One was Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister of Iran, and the other was Jacobo Arbenz, the president of Guatemala. Now, being private lawyers, there was nothing they could do. But they were very, very angry. And in the beginning of 1953, they came into power. John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State. Alan Dulles became Director of the CIA. They carried with them a deep grudge against these two monsters. You know, it was...
John Quincy Adams, who first used that phrase in his brilliant Independence Day address in, I believe it was 1821. He said, America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. But the Dulles brothers did. And the first two monsters they set off against were guys against whom they had a terrible grudge from their days as corporate lawyers. The Dulles brothers did not even wait for Eisenhower to be inaugurated. They didn't even wait to take the oath of office before they started meeting with British agents who had come to Washington to help organize the overthrow of Mossadegh. The operation to overthrow Mossadegh, which was conceived by the Dulles brothers, supported by Foster Dulles, and carried out by Allen Dulles, took only 8 months. After the Dulles brothers came to office, Mossadegh was gone. A great success, so it seemed. What was the result of that? We put the Shah back in power. The Shah ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, which we call now the Islamic Revolution, that brought to power this clique of radical, fanatically anti-American mullahs, and we all know what has happened over the last 35 years. All of that has to do with the Dulles brothers' anger at Mossadegh because he was bothering companies that they represented. It only took less than a year, another 10 months after Mossadegh was overthrown. They had taken care of Arbenz in Guatemala and thrown Guatemala on this path to horror from which it's barely escaping now. Now, there's been a lot of debate among historians, and I don't put myself in that category, really, on the question of why did the Dulles brothers do it? So did they overthrow these people because they were bothering American companies? Or did they overthrow them because they thought they were communists or somehow pro-Soviet or threatening American interests? I've come to believe that there really isn't much difference between these two. They merge into one. And here's the sequence that I see. The American government and the Dulles brothers really do not set out to overthrow foreign governments in order to protect American corporations. They do it because they feel that government is threatening American security interests. But how do they decide that government is threatening American security interests? It's because they're bothering American companies. So it's not directly to protect the companies that they intervene, but the fact that a government is trying to tax or regulate or otherwise bother a big American company is taken as proof that these countries are hostile to the United States. In fact, I found a wonderful document from the ambassador from Brazil to Washington, who during the period when the overthrow of Arbenz was being planned, went to visit Foster Dulles, and he wrote a report back to his embassy his foreign ministry in Brazil about his interview. And in this, he says, I asked Dulles, how do you know that the land reform program in Guatemala was imposed because Moscow told the Guatemalans to do this? And Dulles replied to me, it is true we have no evidence, but we are proceeding on the assumption that it must be so. And if you go through the Dulles brothers' mentality, you understand that it would be very easy for them to do that. Now, there was a special reason why they were able to carry out operations like this so easily without any opposition within the government. And that is that being brothers, being so intimately connected and sharing so much of their experience and their world perspective, they never had to ask anybody else. Under normal circumstances, had you had unrelated people in the jobs of Secretary of State and CIA director, when you came up with the idea, let's overthrow the government of Guatemala, for example, maybe the half a dozen Latin America experts from the State Department and a half a dozen Latin America experts from the CIA would be called together to a meeting, and we talk about whether this is a good idea or whether maybe it's going to have some bad results. No meeting like that was ever held during the Dulles era. They never asked anyone or even told anyone. There were only two Iran specialists in the State Department at that time. They didn't even know this project was going on. So the two of them were kind of a reverberating echo chamber for their own shared certainties. And this allowed them to carry out operations
just because the two of them decided they wanted to do it. Now, this raises the question about President Eisenhower. There's been a lot of back and forth, if you follow the scholarship about the Dulles brothers over the years, on this question. So did the Dulles brothers manipulate Eisenhower, or did they do it behind his back, or was Eisenhower supporting them? We now know from documents that Eisenhower was an enthusiastic supporter of covert action. He knew these operations were going on. He approved them at every step of the way. Why? Well, Eisenhower came from an era when you didn't write about these things. You didn't talk about these things. In his memoirs, he lies completely about these operations and what he knew about them. But he wouldn't have called it a lie. He, don't forget, his career was in the military. He would have said, there are some secrets that you're given, and you don't tell those secrets. And in those days, you could really believe that nobody would ever know. If you had gone to President Eisenhower in the 50s and said to him, I really don't understand why you ordered that operation against Arbenz, he'd look you right in the face and say, I don't know what you're talking about. But I believe he had a couple of reasons to support covert action. First of all, we now know, as nobody knew until 20 or 30 years ago, that covert operations had a huge impact in the outcome of World War II. Not just the breaking of German codes, but a whole series of fake armies and planted messages. Eisenhower, of course, would have known about all these as the Supreme Allied Commander. So he would have come out of World War II with a profound appreciation of what covert action could do. And secondly, I think that Eisenhower would have seen covert action and overthrowing governments through the CIA as a kind of a peace project. He would see it as the alternative to war. He was amazed when Arbenz and Mossadegh were overthrown at the cost of just a few hundred lives. He couldn't believe this. He had sent people out on operations where thousands would die in a single day. So he would have seen this as a great life-saving project. Eisenhower had a military defense plan called the New Look. And it was based on two principles. Eisenhower wanted to cut the defense budget. He was one of those crazy Republicans who believed that you can't overspend. And that's even more important than defense. He had several statements we find in private meetings. No matter how important a weapons system is for us, if it's more than our economy can stand, we don't want it. So he had an answer to this, the New Look. And the New Look was reduce the standing army and use a nuclear deterrent instead. But we now know that the New Look actually had three parts, not just two. It was smaller army, nuclear deterrent, and covert action. So that was his approach, and he fully blessed everything that the Dulles brothers did. In fact, in a few cases, he even urged them on. He pushed them. There was a period of just a couple of weeks in 1960 when Eisenhower did something that, as far as we know, no other president had ever done, which is order the assassination of a foreign leader. In fact, he did it twice. He was directly involved in telling the Dulles brothers to assassinate Fidel Castro, and just as determined that they go out to the Congo and assassinate Patrice Lumumba. So the first two monsters that the Dulles brothers went after were easily vanquished. The third one wasn't so easy. In 1954, John Foster Dulles was the American delegate as Secretary of State to a major conference in Geneva to decide the future of Vietnam. That was right at the time when the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, and it, to their great pain, concluded, we've lost the war in Vietnam, and we have to withdraw. At that conference, the French admitted they had lost, and the British also agreed. And the British counseled the Americans to understand this. Churchill, of course, had been in many wars, and he had a great line. He told Dulles, great quote, the loss of the fortress must be faced. In other words, we can't stop Ho Chi Minh. We don't like it, but he's immensely popular, and he's powerful, and we've tried, but we can't defeat him, and we're just going to have to let that one go and move on to the next project. Foster Dulles could not accept this. He walked out of the Geneva Conference. It's the only time in American history that a Secretary of State has left a major international conference in the middle. And the reason he left was he could see that he was isolated. Everybody else wanted to let Vietnam fall under Ho Chi Minh's rule and forget about it. The Dulles brothers refused to do that. They launched a major action against Ho Chi Minh, determined to crush him. And that is exactly what led us into the war in Vietnam. Had John Foster Dulles come home from Geneva and said, you know, the French told me, Churchill told me, I'm going to take the same view that they did, which is, I hate this, but you can't defeat Ho Chi Minh, and let's just leave it. If that one person had made that one decision on that one day, there wouldn't have been any American involvement in fighting in Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh was one monster that the Dulles brothers could not slay. They then moved on to another East Asian, Sukarno, the neutralist leader of Indonesia. Neutralism was exactly his sin. He called it in the Indonesian language rowing between two reefs. But the Americans hated this. Aside from Bolshevism, there was nothing Foster Dulles hated more than neutralism. Indonesia, India under Nehru, Egypt under Nasser, Burma under Aung San, the father of Aung San Suu Kyi, and a number of other East Asian nations or Asian nations embraced neutralism. Then neutralism began spreading into Africa. Neutralism was what Foster Dulles called the most profoundly immoral policy. And when Sukarno appealed to him personally and told him, leave us alone. We're not against you. We're just neutral. We don't want to be involved in this. Why can't you leave us alone? Dulles' reply was, our policy is global. This is really another aspect of the Dulles view of the world that we still, I think, hold on to today. We have vital interests everywhere. We have to be involved everywhere. The Dulles brothers were among the founders of the Council on Foreign Relations. And for a long time, that really was the clique of people who made all American foreign policy. And that was a very small group. They all knew each other. They all went to the same schools. They all worked for the same law firms and investment banks and had all the same perspective on the world. While I was researching this book, I found that the Council on Foreign Relations actually has a slogan. I didn't know this. It's published on the cover of their magazine, Foreign Affairs, but you don't really notice it. So it's a logo. It's the logo of Pegasus. It's the little flying horse. And then there's a one word written on the top, which I always thought was just some kind of chicken scratch. But when you look at it closely, it's a word in Latin. And the word is ubique, means everywhere. That really was the word that guided the Dulles brothers. When you have a vital interest somewhere, it means you got to go to war to defend it. That's why countries should be very careful in defining what really is a vital interest. But for the Dulles brothers, everything was vital. And everywhere was where we had to be involved. The civil war that the Dulles brothers fomented in Indonesia failed. They were not able to have Sukarno overthrown. But they threw Indonesia into a chaos that in the mid-1960s resulted in a confrontation that ended up killing more than a million people. More than a million people were slaughtered in the period of 1965 and 66. And that intense confrontation that led to such an explosion really has its roots in the Dulles intervention in Indonesia during the mid-50s. After that, they went on to Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, and we see what is now happening in the Congo. Patrice Lumumba was essentially the last popular leader the Congo ever had. He was only in power for a few months, thanks to the Dulles brothers. He was not only overthrown, but assassinated. And then, of course, their last monster was Fidel Castro, who they didn't really succeed in overthrowing. And in fact, it was after the Bay of Pigs invasion that John F. Kennedy finally decided to fire Alan Dulles. One thing I notice in this book that I don't think has ever been pointed out before is that by the time Alan Dulles organized the Bay of Pigs invasion, he was fading. He didn't participate in many of the meetings. He didn't really know what was going on. He wasn't even in Washington on the day of the invasion. Later on, a couple of years later, after he was out of office, he was found
wandering the streets of Georgetown, really not knowing how to get home. So I do think he was already suffering perhaps from some of the early stages of dementia. And that might have been part of the reason why he allowed an operation to go on, even though many of the people directly involved in it understood that it was going to fail and be a disaster. And Kennedy's response afterwards was, "How could I have been so stupid?" And I think this might have been part of the reason why when the missile crisis came up, he didn't listen so much to his military and CIA advisors. So the Dulles brothers carried out all of these operations. And then Foster Dulles left to huge public acclaim. He died in office. Alan Dulles suffered a little less kind of fate as people, he left office under a cloud after the Bay of Pigs. But Alan Dulles was still alive when John F. Kennedy inaugurated Dulles Airport. And you can go on YouTube and see the clip of President Kennedy giving the opening speech for Dulles Airport. Eisenhower was there. Alan Dulles was there. And he pulls back a little curtain and he unveils that very large bust of John Foster Dulles that stands in the center of Dulles Airport. Now, why have none of you ever noticed this bust? I went to the airport to find it while I was working on this book. One of my friends here, old classmate, went with me. We're going to find the Dulles bust. Well, we read. It's at the center of the airport, overlooking the main reflecting pool that Eros Saarinen put in there as a way to kind of calm the turbulent spirits of stressed-out travelers. But there is no reflecting pool. We're looking everywhere. We can't find it. So what happened? The airport authority people didn't know. None of the guards knew. It's a very long story. I won't bore you with all the details. But finally, we were able to locate it with the help of the airport authority. The large bust of John Foster Dulles is now in a closed conference room opposite baggage claim number 3. You can't see it. I think we may have been the only people who don't work for the airport authority that have seen it in decades. It disappeared at some point. So they said, well, during the 90s, there was a renovation, and if we were finished, the bust wasn't there anymore. Nobody knows, at least nobody that I could find, what happened. The Dulles brothers have really been airbrushed out of our history. And I think a big part of the reason is that their approach to the world really didn't work out well. It didn't work out well for the United States, and it didn't work out well for their target countries. Rather than confront this reality, we've tried to forget the Dulles brothers. Now, also during my research, I came across a magnificent artistic masterpiece. I consider this one of the greatest works of political art of the 20th century. It's a mural painted by Diego Rivera. Now, right after Arbenz was overthrown in 1954, there were huge protests in Latin America. I just had lunch yesterday with Ricardo Lagos, the recent president of Chile. He told me that as a teenager, he rioted. He demonstrated in front of the U.S. Embassy on the day after the coup in Chile as a college student. Well, so did Diego Rivera. Diego Rivera and his wife Frida Kahlo participated in a protest rally. Frida Kahlo was deathly ill and was under doctor's orders not to move out of her bed. But she was so outraged by the overthrow of Arbenz that she insisted. And Diego Rivera pushed her in a wheelchair in the front of the protest rally in Mexico with all these signs denouncing America for overthrowing democracy in Guatemala. Frida Kahlo died 11 days later. Diego Rivera went on to paint this spectacular 16-foot-long mural depicting the Guatemala coup. There you see Foster Dulles shaking hands with his Guatemalan lackey, while Alan Dulles is right behind him with a big satchel of cash. And there you see the bought-off archbishop and the American ambassador who carried it all. Meanwhile, you've got these Guatemalan laborers breaking their backs with huge loads of bananas that they're carrying onto a ship with an American flag with all dead Guatemalan children in front of them. It's a spectacular piece. I have seen many reproductions of this painting, and I've stared at it literally for hours. So I decided that while writing this book, I got to go see that picture.
Now, that painting has a very tortured history. It had been it was shown in Guatemala for about 6 months. That would have been about 5 or 6 years ago. I missed that. So I want to track it down. It's not in Guatemala anymore. So, of course, I figured it's got to be in Mexico with all of the Diego Rivera paintings. It was very difficult to locate where in Mexico it was. I finally had to hire someone in Mexico to go to all the Diego Rivera foundations and figure it out. Finally, I came back to the answer that this picture is not in Mexico. This picture is in a museum in Moscow because Diego Rivera was a communist. He sent it to the Soviets, but the Soviets didn't want to display it because Diego Rivera was actually only considered himself a communist. He was not pro-Soviet. He was quite a free thinker, and the Soviets didn't like him. So I finally located the museum where this painting is, and through a Russian lady who helped me with a lot of emails, I was able to contact the assistant director of that museum. And I got back an email, and it said, "I'm sorry to tell you that that painting is not on display. It's on a roll, rolled up in our storage room. If you would like to come to Moscow, as you said, you'd like to, we can take you into the basement and show you the roll. But we cannot unroll it because we don't have the space." So this brilliant masterpiece is never seen. And actually, the audience that needs to see it is really not in Russia, and it's really not in Guatemala. It's here. We're the ones that need to see that picture. So this is my modest proposal. Dulles Airport. Let us place the bust back where it was. Let us bring the Diego Rivera mural and let Americans confront the Dulles brothers and what they mean for us. Thank you.
You bring it out with me.